Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. We have everything you need to update your window treatments with Window Images blinds and shades. We carry vinyl, aluminum, and faux wood blinds, cellular shades, and more. Plus, get them trimmed to width in-store for free. Also, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. You're number two, burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw, now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
I picked up the phone and called the FBI.
This is true.
So I called the FBI and said, look, there's a guy here that somebody tells me you're looking for. If I tell you where he is and, you know, will you tell me if you're looking for him? Sure. So I told him, he said, we'll call you back in 20 minutes. Well, 20 minutes later, the place was surrounded by FBI guys.
No.
You could see them. They're sticking their heads up. Finally, one of the guys comes up to the door and he says, knock, knock. We're looking for Sly Stone. Yeah, he's over here. So they took him to the Bridgeport jail and, and sent him back to California. Yeah. Damn.
What's happening, family? My name is Al Thomas, and you're watching In the Black of My Mind podcast. Do me a favor and go to the bottom of the screen and click subscribe, like, and comment, and tell everybody about this podcast. How many bodies? Everybody's. Tell everybody about the podcast. Today's guest is a musician, a recording engineer, a philanthropist, a businessman, and the proprietor of a legendary institution, Horizon Studios, Horizon Music Group. Welcome to the podcast, Vic Steffens.
Thanks,
how you
bud.
Feeling, bro?
Yeah, I'm good.
Good, good, good.
Fight the war as always, you know.
Okay. I appreciate you doing this, man.
I'm happy to do it.
Cool, cool. Now, I want to get back to the basics because I'm just trying to let folks know who we're dealing with here and where you came from and all that kind of stuff. Well, where were you born, bro?
I was actually born in New York, New York.
Uh-huh.
But my family immediately moved up to Connecticut. We lived I was very young, lived in Meriden, and then moved to Cheshire, which is where I spent most of my formative years.
Well, I know some people spending some formative years in Cheshire, but it's a different kind of vibe where they're at.
Mm.
Any brothers and sisters?
I have three sisters. Mm. One who is the infamous Christina Ullman, the singer.
Oh,
The Saturday Night Live band. So you might not even know that she's my sister.
I know.
Very popular in Eastern United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I have two other sisters. One is in North Carolina, and the other is in Milford, Connecticut.
Well, where's the last one? I'm sorry.
Milford.
Oh, in Milford. Okay.
Yeah.
Are the two involved in music at all, or
not
in the arts?
Well, my youngest sister is into theater. She actually runs a couple of theaters down in the in North Carolina. And my other sister, no, she's I think head of the Board of Education or something in Milford right now.
Oh, cool, cool, cool.
Yeah.
When did you first start playing music?
Sixth grade.
Right.
My sister had found some pictures in Life magazine on the last page of these guys named the Beatles. And she walked into my room and said, do you know anything about this? And so it looked interesting. So we started checking it out. And I ended up becoming interested in playing the drums. I remember getting a snare drum in sixth grade and almost getting thrown out of class for banging on my desk with stirrers. But then, you know, from there, actually, I played a little bit of guitar. My sister and I used to play, like, at some churches and coffee houses.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I became more involved with drums and started putting bands together. She wasn't initially in them, but at one point she did join the band, and we started rehearsing. And in my favorite story was we used to rehearse in my parents' basement, and this woman moved in next door with her husband. She had been a big band singer in New York, and she used to hear us rehearse. One day she came over and, "Oh, you guys are really good. I'm going to get you a record deal." Like, "Yeah, right. Of course you are."
Sure. But
except she did.
Oh, wow.
She calls us up a couple weeks later and says, "Sorry, you go to New York. You have to be in these three places at these three times. You're auditioning for three record companies." The third one, which was an independent company, signed us. They were called Mainstream Records. And they had a few people on the label. The guy was an ex-Mercury A&R guy. He was very astute. He had signed this girl from San Francisco, Janis Joplin.
Oh, wow.
Big brother in the holding company. There were nobody yet. Uh-huh. But, you know, they did put out a record which had their first single, Call on Me, on it, which charted. Not huge, but it definitely got them off the ground. They had another band called the Amboy Dukes, which had a number one record with their guitar player, Ted Nugent.
Oh, wow.
So this guy, you know, he was pretty good. And he was like, what had happened was after Big Brother and the Holding Company record came out, Columbia stole them from him.
Hmm.
They're a much bigger label. They had more money. They stole them. And so he wanted to get somebody to replace her on the label. And that was my sister, because she, you know, we were doing kind of blues rocky stuff, what they had done.
Mm-hmm.
And so they signed us, and we did a couple of records with them before they just said, well, this didn't work, and they dropped us.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, early on, we were like 16, 17 years old. They took us to New York, put us in A&R Studios, which at the time was the biggest studio in New York,
mm-hmm.
with Phil Ramone was our engineer, who later went on to produce Billy Joel and Paul Simon, all these huge people.
Yeah.
But he was just an engineer then, although he was part owner of the studio. He did our sessions, and it was just a great way to get started. You know, even if it didn't pan out in the long run, we knew what to do after that.
Right. So now, so you were still in high school during this period of time.
Yeah. Exactly.
Mm. Did it interfere with studies and stuff?
Sure. How could it not? You know, I mean, when I got out of high school, I went to Wesleyan. I got a full scholarship to go to Wesleyan University, which is, you know, a great, fabulous school.
A great school, yeah.
Great school. But for me, it wasn't where I was going. So I ended up leaving after 2 years to play drums and bands. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Much to my parents' chagrin. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure.
Yeah. But, you know, I've never had a day job, so I guess it must have worked out pretty well.
Wow. Yeah, that's a beautiful thing.
It is. Trust me.
That's a beautiful thing.
Not much you can say about them. How the hell did that happen? You know?
Hey, man, you when you, what's that, that's, if you enjoy doing something, figure out a way to get paid for doing it, and you never work a day in your life?
I never have.
Hmm.
I mean, people sometimes say, "Oh, you work so many hours." It's, what do you mean? I don't work at all. You know? I've never really worked. You know, I never really had a job where I had to show up at a certain time and do this that somebody was telling me what to do.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I wish that were my story.
I don't blame you. It's a good story if you can get it. You know.
Yeah. So now you had that. Did you have the opportunity to do any touring while you're out playing with these different bands and stuff?
We toured the Northeast.
Okay.
You know, and we were really big. This band was called the Scratch Band, and it was probably at the time the single most popular, you know, barish band in the Northeast. We were doing very, very well. And my sister was in it. She went on to the Saturday Night Live Orchestra. Our guitar player, our second guitar player, was G.E. Smith, who went on to be Hall & Oates and...
Oh, wow.
It plays right now with some of the Pink Floyd guys. I mean, he's, you know, he's had a very good career also.
Mm.
So the three of us, and then some of the other people, there was two singers in the band. It was sort of like a White Sam and Dave thing. You know, there were two singers up front. And the other guy is in a band called the Soul Drivers from Hartford, and I just did a record with them a couple of years ago. I did very well.
Mm.
So we had people that, they weren't the normal bar floggers, you know.
Right.
It was a lot better than that.
When did you know that you were going to be doing music as a career?
Very early on.
Is that right?
Yeah. You know, when I remember my mom got me this, the one time I ever had a day job, was for 3 weeks. She got me a job at a gas station in Cheshire. And I would go there, and the guy was an idiot. I got myself fired after 3 weeks, and I said right then, not doing this anymore. So and that was it. You know?
Wow.
Somehow it worked out. Don't ask me how.
Right. You know? Yeah, I remember I was telling somebody, I worked at McDonald's for 3 days.
Right.
And the third day, they put me on the grill, training or anything. And this is down in Stamford. And they had just opened up a new movie theater in Landmark Square.
Okay.
And so I'm on the grill. And then the movie theater closes up, and all the people from the movie theater come over to the McDonald's.
Right.
So it's packed in there. And so, man, I got burgers over here. I got fries over here. I got pies down. I got everything. And all of a sudden, all of the buzzers are going off, man. And I'm flipping and trying to make Big Macs and all that kind of stuff. And it just wasn't happening. And the manager that was on came and was screaming at me and said, go downstairs and take a break. I'm like, man, I had no training, man. Are you guys going to, this is on the third day, this is how you don't bring anybody back here to help me or anything. I went downstairs, I'm sitting on the bench, and I changed my clothes and walked out of there and never looked back. So McDonald's Corporation, if you're listening, you all owe me for 3 days.
I bet they do. With interest.
With interest, right, from 1974. Wow. How did you get into engineering?
When we got dropped by Mainstream, the New York company, kind of the only game in town around here was this place, Trodnossel Recording.
Oh, in Wallingford?
In Wallingford, yeah.
Yeah, I remember.
My sister... She was kind of dating Al Anderson at the time from the Wild Weeds. And so they were there, and he introduced us, and they ended up, I guess I would say, signing us, although in retrospect, it wasn't much of a signing. But I mean, we were there for years and we learned a lot. We were a band, but we were also in the studio all the time. And we also did a lot of studio work. So, I was in the studio quite a bit, and I became more and more and more interested in it. And then at some point, there was a lot of crazy stuff going on there. The owner was, he got into Scientology.
Oh, okay.
Which I wasn't very interested in getting into. You know?
Right, so
at that point, you couldn't really be there if you weren't interested in Scientology. So I left.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just pressure all the time. So I left. And a couple of years, I was just very frustrated. But I was in other bands, and we were doing okay, but it wasn't really going anywhere. One day I picked up the New Haven Advocate, the newspaper at the time, and I see in the back this thing, the Business Academy of Music. It was a course, a weekend course that you could take with some guy who I didn't know who it was. But I was like, well, I got to do something here. And, at the time, back in the 70s, you couldn't learn anything about the music business like you can now on the internet.
You could find out something.
And back then, nobody would tell you anything because if you knew something, they might not be able to take advantage of you.
So
I went to take this course. I had to drive to Boston to do it. And I met this guy, Marty Kugel, Marty had produced In the Still of the Night.
Oh, wow.
It was a giant record. He produced it in the basement of a church in East Haven, Connecticut. And the record was huge. And he was like sort of maybe a little bit starting to be out of it, but he knew everybody and he knew everything. And it was a fantastic course. And at the end of the course, he approached me and he said, you've done a lot more stuff than anybody here. What's your story? Why are you here? And I told him the story, which is, I had left there and I kind of felt like, once I left, I became a non-person because they knew everybody and they never let us know anybody. So I said, well, take this phone number down, call this guy, and he's looking for some people. He's renovating a mansion in Northwest Connecticut, and he's looking for people to help, and he's paying them a studio time so you can do demos, you can do stuff. So that was Paul Lecca, who produced Harry Chapin, produced REO Speedwagon.
Oh, wow.
Produced a lot of hit records in his studio on Main Street in Bridgeport, Connecticut, 1122 Main Street.
Mm.
So I met the guy, and I ended up, you know, he became a dear friend and a mentor, and I used to run the studio for him after a while.
Oh, okay.
And I also, you know, did some playing on some records. Angela Clemens, Give Me Just a Little More Time. I played drums on that with my friend Scott Spray on bass, who I record every week now. So that kind of put me into the loop of what was going on. And Paul took me to New York with him on many occasions, and we would meet these guys that I would never have met, you know. Jerry Greenberg, president of Atlantic Records. Ron Alexenberg, head of A&R at Sony, and many more, you know. Jimmy Iovine, you know. Jimmy Einer, I'm sorry, who produced Dirty Dancing, you know.
Yeah.
And we would just go to their office and, you know, play.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Stuff and that, you know, he said, yeah, bring some of your stuff. Yeah, you know, they would like my stuff, you know. And I started, you know, just getting into that circle of people a little bit, which was, to me, was like just unbelievable. You know, I had never been able to figure out how to do it. You know, I would call people, but they wouldn't talk to you. The secretaries would, one label, I remember, they had a button in the office, and if they didn't know you were, they hit the button, they would go to a recording and say, get lost, you know.
Oh, okay.
They just didn't really have the time or the energy to talk to new people.
Right.
But with him behind me, I could call anybody and say, hey, blah, 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 and I could get in the office. So that really got me started in a much better circle of people.
So when did you start Horizon?
I started Horizon. I had built at my home in Hamden, Connecticut, at that time. We had built a small home studio. It was actually one of the very first real home studios. We were getting written up in like national magazines. Because it was a new idea, you know. And so I was doing that, and then one day, couple of people come by that a friend of mine had sent over to do some demos, and they, you know, we started talking, and it turns out that they were from Norway, and there were two, a guy and a girl. The guy, his family was like mega rich in Norway. He used to show me pictures of, it was like an 800-foot tanker. With his initials on the
right.
Oh, that's you.
Yeah,
and he was a great guy, and the woman, you know, they were buying houses and flipping houses down in the Wilton area to make money. And they bought a house from Ace Frehley from Kiss.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So they had this place, and this place had a gorgeous recording studio built in the bottom of it. They had taken all, there was no more equipment. Ace took, when he sold the house, he took all the equipment. But the build out was there, and it was beautiful. And like 1989. And in 1989, there was a huge real estate crash in the southern Connecticut. So they bought this house for $1.5 million, thinking they were going to sell it for $2 million, and all of a sudden it was worth $800,000. So they didn't want to sell it, you know. So he says to me, he met me, and he said, you know, would you be interested in becoming a partner, and we'll open this recording studio, and we'll use the studio to pay the mortgage to keep the thing afloat, and then, you know, we'll see what happens in the future. If we sell it, we'll give you money, if we, you know, whatever. So we did it, and it was a gigantic success. You know, they had money, so we were able to finance equipment. We got everything going in there. I at the time was doing some consulting for this company, Alan Heath, an audio company, and they would take me to all the trade shows, like the NAMM show and the AES show. So I was meeting a lot of people. And among other things, I had met this guy, Willie Wilcox, who was Todd Rundgren's drummer. And Willie was looking to move from the West Coast to the East Coast. So he came and he moved into the house and put a studio in it. Mm-hmm. And I had a big studio in the basement. We were doing all sorts of great things. Mm-hmm. We were doing fabulous until the guy's wife found out he was having an affair with the other woman.
Okay.
So there's a big divorce thing happening. And I mean, to go through all the nonsense, he ends up losing the house to his ex-wife, now his ex-wife, who was not even remotely interested in having it. But that was Horizon. And we were doing major records there. Someone who became a dear friend of mine, Michael Chapman, was the biggest producer. And he was like Puffy in 1970.
Oh, wow.
Every week he was on the cover of Billboard. And at the time he was producing Lita Ford, the great chick guitar player. Mm. And he loved the studio. It was like 5 minutes from his house. He lived in Easton.
Oh, okay.
And he didn't want to have to go to New York to record. But with us, he would just come to the place. He'd have the artist stay upstairs. He didn't have to get a hotel. We were far enough away from everything that he didn't have to worry about them disappearing and going to get in trouble.
Right.
And he was like the greatest producer in the world. Mm. So like hundreds of millions of records. And so he was hanging out there, and I was there, and I just learned tons of stuff from him. That's also when I was there where Willie Wilcox, the drummer, introduced me to this guy who was managing Sly Stone.
Mm.
And this is right about when the second Woodstock was going to happen, and they wanted to make a record with Sly that they could put out for that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he brought him from the West Coast to Wilton, Connecticut, and I was going to run the sessions, which was great for me. I honestly didn't even really have that much cred, but there were some things I didn't know. One, he wasn't supposed to leave California legally, but they brought him anyway. Two, it was all mafia money.
Oh, okay.
And they had some mafia guys from every Tuesday. Some guy would come up from New Jersey and bring drugs.
Oh.
And they give all these drugs to Sly. He would get high. And then we go record.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as he was getting drugs, he would keep recording.
Okay.
Which went on for quite a while until, I became friendly with Sly. And he realized that these guys were just jacking him. It wasn't going to be a record or anything. And I suggested a couple of attorneys to him, which they found out about. And then they decided that they had enough of him being in Wilton. One day, one of the mafia guys says to me, he says, you better be careful. Some crap's going to go on next week. And if you don't know about it, you might get in trouble.
Wow.
Didn't tell me what it was. So I didn't sleep for like 3 days. But on the third day, I woke up and I realized they're going to bust him and take him back to California so they can control him again. Because they felt they were losing their grip on the guy. So
right. Dang.
I picked up the phone and called the FBI.
This is true.
So I called the FBI and said, look, there's a guy here that somebody tells me you're looking for. If I tell you where he is and, will you tell me if you're looking for him? Sure. So I told him, he said, we'll call you back in 20 minutes. Well, 20 minutes later, the place was surrounded by FBI guys.
No.
You could see them, they're sticking their heads up. Finally, one of the guys comes up to the door and he says, knock, knock. We're looking for Sly Stone. Yeah, he's over here. So they took him to the Bridgeport jail and sent him back to California. Yeah.
Day.
So that was just an interesting little thing that happens to you. And there were many little things like that going on at the time.
Oh, I'm sure.
It was a much crazier business than it is now.
This is Marian Meadows, and you're listening to and watching In the Black of My Mind podcast.
What was it like working with Sly, though?
Well, I loved it. Mm-hmm. Even though... most of the time when he's in the studio, he was high. And
right.
I really spent a lot of time trying to talk him out of that.
Mm.
And we became, buddies, but he wasn't going to change because of me. I was
right.
I was a little guy. He was a big guy.
Yeah.
And, but the single most creative person I've ever encountered on the planet is what I would say about him.
Wow.
He could do, if you handed him an instrument that he didn't know how to play and came back in 3 hours, he'd be playing it.
Yeah.
He sang everything. He was one of the first guys I mean, Stevie Wonder used to do this. He would sing all the parts on those records.
Oh, okay.
Varus, he would Varus be the tape machine, like take it down halfway. He'd sing the part, and then it would be like falsetto on the record. And that he was doing all that kind of stuff. He was great.
Well, yes, yeah, so I mean, definitely ahead of his
25
time.
25 years later, I got a phone call from an attorney in L.A. who was pro saying representing Sly to sue those managers for $50 million because they'd stolen all his publishing.
Right.
They stole it all.
Wow.
And so they didn't win that, but they did win $5 million or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was a trip, you know, go down there and get grilled by some attorney. But there was nothing. I was telling the truth, you know.
Right.
I knew the story because they would talk to me. They thought I was on their side, you know. What they didn't realize is that Sly, first of all, he's a super intelligent guy.
Mm.
Yeah, this is a very smart person. And he would let them think he was high, and he would just be, but he would be listening to everything they said. So he knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that, you know. So, but he was great. I haven't seen him in ages. You know, they keep him pretty walled off. But he is out of that. And from what his attorney told me, he's clean and somewhat healthy. You know?
Oh, okay. Okay.
So I hope he's good.
I mean, I know he was past his prime at that point, but could you still see, like, the musical brilliance?
The musical brilliance was 100% intact.
Wow.
But the rest of it wasn't. I mean, the desire to go in to fight that war was not really there anymore.
Right.
He did do a record at one point, which I didn't think was very good, actually, with some European guy who just, I don't know, he didn't know what he was doing. But, you know, nonetheless, I mean, he could make a record today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to do that one. I tried to get him on a couple of things, but just too much in the way, you know. To make
right. Wow. So when did you move over there to where you're at currently?
Well, we ran the place in Wilton. I think it's on 91 or 91.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And at that point, it just became untenable. Yeah, we knew we were going to get thrown out by the wife.
Okay.
And we actually tried to buy the place because we knew she was going to lose it to foreclosure. She was like an unemployed teacher now with a $15,000 a month mortgage. Probably not going to work, you know?
Yeah, I would say.
So we got a backer, and myself and the other woman who had been involved, she was still here. The other guy moved back to Norway.
Mm-hmm.
But she was still here, and you know, she had an interest in it. So we found another backer. We tried to buy it at the auction for the house, and they just wouldn't budge.
Wow.
And so meanwhile, we had found out about this place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at first I didn't want to move here, but then I realized that if I didn't make the move, I was probably going to be out of the studio business.
Oh, okay.
I didn't think I would be able to get the funding to get back in. So I said, well, what the hell, I'll take the shot, you know. So we came up here, and these guys had all sorts of problems. They had drug problems. I could go, whatever it is, it reached a point where, you know, we had to buy them out, which was great. And we did. And it's just been that from here, 35 years in this place. You know?
Wow.
So, you know, and it was a blessing for me because, you know, when I was down in Wilton, I was not that well known at the time. So a lot of times they would bring their own engineers and people. I mean, I ran the studio. We were buddies. Once in a while, I'd do something. But for the most part, it was just keep an eye on what's going on.
Right.
But when we came here, it was like, okay, your thing. Go do it. And I did. So. And then you showed up.
Right.
Amongst others, you know.
Yeah, well, man, please, everybody has nothing but good things to say about you, and you helped so many people and stuff, man. That's why at the beginning of when I was introducing you, I put the philanthropist part in there because you have given to so many in the business up this way.
You know, I don't even see it as that. To me, I just see it all as part of a bigger picture of what's going on, you know, and
right.
When you do something for somebody, something comes back.
Right.
It always does. I've never seen it. Well, I can think of two people. But it's a remarkably short list of people that didn't reciprocate the way they were supposed to.
Oh, I hear you.
And to me, it's, I just want to make records. You know,
right.
That's what I want to do. And if somebody's got the ability to make a record, I'm happy to meet you and try to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be big or giant. You just have to be good.
Right. In my mind, yeah. How did the pandemic affect you in the studio?
Believe it or not, we were busier in the pandemic than we were before the pandemic.
Wow. Why is that, you think?
Well, I felt that it was because people couldn't really play live. There were no live shows.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So, but let's face it, music people want to do music. You know. So
yeah.
Instead, they would show up here and make a record and figure, well, we'll put it out when the pandemic's over, but we'll have it done. You know.
Right.
So
right.
We were very busy during that. You know, and that was a blessing because it didn't have to be that way.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Name some of the folks that people would know that have recorded that.
The Benyer?
Yeah.
Well, Bobby Brown.
Hmm.
Whitney was here once or twice with Bobby.
Okay.
Harry Connick Jr. The Blues Brothers did a lot of stuff with some of those guys. Donna Summer was here once or twice. Yeah.
Okay, okay.
You look at people over the years. It just happens when it happens. It doesn't happen as much as it used to because everybody has a home studio now.
Right, right, right.
But it's okay. I get to do what I want to do, so I'm happy.
Okay. Now, you said the Blues Brothers. That was Matt Guitar Murphy was with them?
Matt, yeah, I did two albums with Matt.
Okay.
He was terrific. Terrific guy.
You know, I think I recall talking to you briefly about him. My dad was in the Air Force.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Okay.
And over in Europe, and I was telling the story to someone up here not too long ago, but anyway, he went into the NCO club, and he loved music, so he would go to NCO club, and there was a bunch of guys in there that were playing, and they didn't have a drummer. So they were like, he said, Al, I was sitting on the drums. He said, man, I'm not no drummer. He said, yeah, you're probably better than these guys because nobody could keep time. So my dad said he wasn't a drummer, but he said as long as they kept feeding him alcohol, he could keep time.
I believe that.
So he ended up playing all over Europe with them, and the leader of that band was Matt Guitar Murphy.
Oh, wow.
And he was going to stay in Europe. He never wanted to come back home.
Mm-hmm.
And he had 1 month. His time had expired over in Europe, but he had 1 month before he was getting out of service. And they wouldn't let him get out there. They wanted him to come back to the States and to out-process, excuse me. And so he ended up going to California. But before he left, he threw his cymbals in the Thames River, and he never played again. And so he never got a chance to see Matt when he came back to the States. And so I think you were talking about him, and I said, oh, man, I would love to hook my dad up with him. And I think you said okay, but Matt had a stroke or something like that at that time.
He did.
Yeah, and so I wasn't able to. We weren't able to make that happen, but yeah, it's unfortunate.
Matt was first of all, a great musician. People don't realize if you start investigating his history, who he played with back in the Chicago days. He played with all of the Muddy Waters people and Howlin' Wolf. He played with everybody.
Wow.
And very astute musician and great guy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was very surprising when he had a stroke because he was a physically, he was very strong. You know, the first time I ever met him, when he walked in the door over there, he had two twin reverbs, one in each hand. Now, if you know about a Fender twin reverb, that ain't light.
Yeah. It's like concrete in the bottom of those
exactly.
things.
Exactly. So, you know, we did a couple of records together. He was just a great guy. His brother Floyd is a fantastic drummer. He played on some of that stuff, and that was also great. I still talk to Floyd. He Matt passed away a couple of years ago. So.
Yeah. I got some rapid fire questions.
Sure.
Who are your musical influences?
Well, the first thing was the Beatles, you know, and maybe the Rolling Stones after that. But my sister and I became very interested in blues and some gospel really early on. I remember listening to I'll Take You There by the Staple Singers, you know, a zillion times. You know, it's like, wow, who's this? Different blues things, you know, a lot of different people, but Paul Butterfield Blues Band was big with me. All of that era was my formative thing.
Okay. How did you get involved with recording gospel music? Because there's so many folks that came through there.
Jonathan Dubose.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
When I was in Bridgeport with Paul Lecca, it was like mid-70s, I'll always remember. You know Michael Brown?
Yes.
Okay. So Michael Brown used to write a lot of songs for Paul. And Angela Clemens was there. And Janice Dempsey was there.
Okay.
And one day, we're getting ready to record something, and Michael brings in this guitar player. He's got this funky Japanese Stratocaster. It had like eagles on it or something. It was really crazy looking. He still has it. It was Jonathan Dubose. So, you know, Jonathan sits down across the room. I was playing drums. He's like over there. And quite frankly, some of the other people on the sessions were kind of like, I was this kid. Mm. Yeah, what does he know how to do? Until he started playing. And he's like, oh, you could stay. At the time, he was. It's funny because he once told me that, you know, he used to do that kind of Nile Rodgers plucky thing.
Yeah.
He said for like the first 5 years, they wouldn't let me do anything else. They wouldn't let me play any chords, you know. And he said, finally, of course, John now knows every chord on the planet, you know. But that was funny the way you said it. So, you know, and then a couple of years after that, I kind of lost track of John. And I got hired by a friend to record a show at Southern Connecticut University in Lyman Auditorium, and it was a gospel show. So I went there to do it. It was Edwin Hawkins.
Right.
And who was playing guitar but Jonathan Dubose. So
you know what? I was playing bongos on that show.
You're kidding.
I kid you not.
Okay. Well.
Yeah.
So, you know, we did that. And, you know, I always hit it off. We always had a good, you know, when we came here, he brought me all of this stuff that he had on 2-inch tape from earlier sessions, and we kind of put it all together and put out that Expect the Unexpected record.
Oh, right.
Which is still a pretty valid record, you know, years later. So, but he really was the person who introduced me to that. And then when we came here also, I think, I'm not sure how directly it came, but I got a call from, you know, I'm not sure who the call was from, but it was about J.C. White.
Oh, okay.
And they were doing a TFT record that was produced by Sanchez Harley, who's a Nashville guy.
Okay.
And they were doing it for Benson Records, Lost and Sold. But they did that here. And that kind of was, between Jonathan and that, kind of launched us into that.
Okay.
Yeah, then I got a call. I mean, J.C., they had Beautiful Praise, which Jonathan and I produced the first one. Dion Kipping came after that because they drew a Beautiful Praise record, and then, you know, various other things. So.
Right. Yeah, I know Brenda Culpepper.
And
all of those folks.
Might have been Brenda that called me. I mean, I love Brenda. She's a dear friend.
Yeah. We tried to get her to manage us, and she you know, we wanted to be on her label and stuff. But at that time, she was just getting out.
Yeah, but you know that was cool. You know, but I still talk to Brenda now and then. You know,
oh, okay.
She was always phenomenally supportive. You know, that's all I can say. But we helped her out a lot too. I mean, I mixed a whole bunch of West Coast Regional Mass Choir with Billy Preston.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that record was sitting around. We just got together and I did that, and that was fun. You know, stuff like that.
Right. What are your hobbies?
I don't have any hobbies. I am what I am.
You know? I hear you.
My hobby is music. I don't think I do anything else.
Wow. You know?
I mean, I might read a little bit or watch a little or that, but
right.
I'm like 90% this.
Right. Thoroughly immersed.
It takes up enough of my time.
You know? I hear you. What is the greatest accomplishment of your life?
Wow. I mean, probably having my kids. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if you could really. I mean, music is great, but you know, I as much as I love music, I don't know if I could say that my greatest accomplishment was any musical thing. There've been so many. Maybe it's just the mere fact that I'm in it.
Right.
Probably the greatest accomplishment. I mean, after all these years, I mean, I had a gospel session last night. It was great. You know, it's like a choir sort of thing. And
okay.
The phone still rings. We're here. You know, a lot of people aren't. So many people aren't. You know?
I was just getting ready to say, man, there's so many studios have closed down. In Connecticut, there's you guys and Carriage House and
Johnny and myself and Doug Copper up in Hartford. But he sold his place to somebody. But that's I forget the name. But he's been up there for maybe that long. The rest of it, you know, relatively recent. You know, it's really hard to stand. I mean, Johnny's been fantastic. He's a great friend. And, you know, we talk now and then about this, that, or another thing. And,
cool. Yeah.
But there's not a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm. His studio was the first studio that I recorded in.
Okay.
Yeah. When they first opened up Carriage House, myself and I don't know if you know Robbie Jenkins.
Yeah.
Actually, sure. Robbie played acoustic on one of our Better
Way. Yeah, I remember that. I mean,
great guitar.
The Carriage House predates me. I mean, when I was working at Leckers in Bridgeport, mid-70s, he was kind of the guy. There was one other place called, I don't remember what it's called, but this guy, Spencer or something, had built this really tricked out house in the Westport area. And he was he was doing a lot of stuff.
And I remember Scoville Studios years ago in Norwalk.
He's around. I still talk to him once in a while.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, most of those places are long, long gone.
Oh, yeah, long gone.
Except for Johnny, who was will be there forever.
Yeah.
And he should be. I mean, he's done great work, and he's got a great facility. And I mean, you know, he's gotten a lot more big clients than I have because he could stay there. That's a big deal. And I always kind of wanted to do that here, but I never could get it together.
Yeah, and it's close proximity to New York City.
Right. When we were in Wilton, people would call us all the time.
Right.
You know, when we lost the studio, we were supposed to do a Deep Purple record. I was all ready for that, but they would never come up here. It was just not. They wanted to go to Ace's old house. You know? that was the whole deal, you know.
Right. Wow.
Hi, my name is Howard Cloud. Please watch In the Black of My Mind with host Al Thomas.
What's on your bucket list?
You know, I would like to have one record that really sells in the larger sense. You know, we've had so many records that have done well on, I would call them ancillary charts. You know, we've had four or five blues records in the last few years that have charted very well on the blues charts.
Uh-huh.
I would just like to have one record in the top 10 of Billboard someday.
Right.
I don't even know if it means anything anymore. I was talking to my friend Mike Kaplan, who was head of A&R at Sony for years. And he says, I don't even know if Billboard means anything anymore, you know?
Wow.
So that was kind of for him to say that was kind of a tricky statement. You know?
Right.
But I would love to have one just to be able to say that I did. You know?
Right.
What it takes to do that, I don't even know anymore.
I know.
Such a bizarre, toxic sort of business, you know? I don't know what to say. But the music is always great. So regardless of that, because I had always said to people, don't make music because you want commercial success.
Right.
Make music because it makes you happy.
Right.
And I think that's one of the reasons why I've been able to be here, because, you know, I don't mind if the project is short a few hours. I don't really care. I'll just do it. If you don't have the money, that's okay. I don't want product out there that doesn't reflect well on you and me.
Right, right.
So if it means spending a few hours on a mix, who cares? You know?
Right.
It's only for the better. And that's kind of always how I saw it. I mean, I probably put X number of hours into your records.
Oh, you did. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. A bunch of hours. Where is the coolest place you ever traveled to?
The coolest place? Wow. Of course, I went to L.A. a bunch of times for the NAMM trade show. That was always fun. Mm-hmm. But I like going to the Blue Ridge Highway in, I guess it was Tennessee, or maybe it's Kentucky, I'm not sure.
Oh, okay, okay.
It runs all the way down the Blue Ridge Mountains into almost Arkansas. And we drove that one year with my family, and that was a fantastic, beautiful experience.
Wow. What makes you unique?
You know, I don't know that I am unique. I think there's plenty of people that can do what I do. Now, are there plenty of people that will do what I do?
Right.
That's another story.
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
And that's probably what makes me unique. I mean, I mean, we're here, we're financially stable, but it's not like we've made billions of dollars.
Right.
We've done okay, and we're here, and I'm happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always say that, you know, for me, the music comes way before the money.
Right, right, right.
You know, we have bills that we have to pay. I know that, and we get them paid. But at the same token, you know, I just don't always see it like that. And I have people that come in here that do see it like that, and they don't stay.
Mm.
You know, because they don't see a meeting of minds. You know.
Right, right.
But that's just the way that is, you know. Not much mm-hmm. more we can say about it. But, you know, honestly, there's plenty of people out there that technically can do what I do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think the difference is the heart of wanting to do something special all the time. And that mm-hmm. was something I learned from Paul Lecker. I mean, he was always just make sure whatever you're doing, do it right.
Right.
Do it well, you know. Because
yeah.
I hear so many records that seem like they were half finished sometimes.
Right. Yeah. Oh, exactly.
Yeah. You know, yeah, it was close, but you really didn't do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No
vocals
cigar.
That were not. You know, you could have sung that better. Yeah, but I
right.
didn't. You know, yeah. I mean, okay, so what are you gonna say? You know. But that's kind of how my life, works out.
Right. Right.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
What is the most important decision you've made to date?
That I can answer. When we were in Wilton in 1990, something like that, and we were about to lose the studio, we got a phone call from somebody that wanted to buy the recording console in the studio.
Uh-huh.
And it was just myself and Ingrid, who was my partner at the time. We were sitting there, and we actually agreed to sell it. And that was before we decided to come here. Then after I made that decision, I started thinking about it, and that's when I realized that I would never get back to where we were. We were in a good place. Even if we had to move, we were here. We had a name. People knew, were learning who I was. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So they were supposed to give us a down payment on a certain day, and they didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I canceled the sale.
Okay.
And that was the single most important decision I ever made.
Wow.
Because once we canceled the sale, we made the commitment to come here.
Okay. Okay.
And that combination of things is why we're having this conversation. Wow. If that hadn't happened on that day, we wouldn't even know each other.
Wow. Wow, that's deep. What's your favorite song?
My favorite song, and there's a few, but it might be Wichita Lineman by Glenn Campbell.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a nice song.
It's a great song.
Walter Beasley just did that over again. Yeah. And he's got a beautiful voice, too.
Oh, yeah, he's good. Yeah. There's a James Taylor version, which actually I didn't think they quite got. Mm. But it was good, you know, but it didn't really, you know. And I met Jimmy Webb a couple of times because Jimmy, the writer, who wrote hundreds of hits, yeah, back in that era, Up and Away, he wrote.
Oh, wow.
He wrote McCarthy Park.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote so many songs that if you saw a list of it, you'd just be, oh, that one.
Right.
And he comes around and he does shows where he plays his songs, him on the grand piano, and he tells stories about how it happened. It's a beautiful, if you ever get to see it.
And tell me his name again.
Jimmy Webb.
Webb. Okay. Yeah.
So, but he wrote Wichita Lineman, and that song was always fabulous. But there's a bunch of them that, you know, that in my mind have that level of stature. But that's the number one for me.
Okay. And your favorite group?
Well, I guess I should say the Beatles, but my favorite, I'll tell you this, and I saw the Beatles at Shea Stadium.
Did you?
I did.
Wow.
But I think my favorite show that I ever saw was at the Oakdale in Wallingford when it was a tent theater.
Okay, yeah.
And it was the Spinners, who were so good. I can't even tell how great that guy was. The show was, they sang great, the presentation was unbelievable, the vibe was so warm and open. I always remember that show.
Now, is that when they used to have the circular stage?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And they
was Felipe Win? I'm sorry?
Yes, he was there.
Oh, okay.
He was singing, and they were doing Rubber Band Man and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Somebody was recently talking to me about covering I'll Be There, and I was like, I'd love to do it, although I couldn't tell anybody could possibly do it as good as they did.
Wow, I met Felipe when he was singing with Parliament Funkadelic at the Apollo.
I didn't even know he was doing that. That's fantastic.
They did a song came out in '79, Knee Deep.
Oh yeah. And,
yeah, that's him singing on.
Oh,
Knee
I
Deep.
Didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, that's him.
What a voice.
Man. Yeah.
But even more so, the personality that radiated from that guy just knocked me off my chair.
Right.
I couldn't believe how good it was. Man. That was a great theater to see. I saw Dionne Warwick there. That was, wow. That was.
Oh, wow.
The Walk On By is another one of my, actually, anyone who had a heart.
Oh, yeah.
To me, that's another one of those bucket list songs, you know. Great song. What she does on the end of that song is just mind-boggling. Great.
That's interesting. Luther Vandross covered it afterwards, and Dion called him when he let Dion hear it. Dion called him up and said, "I hate you."
That's funny. Do you know Carol Sylvan? Do you know Carol?
No.
I record her. She's done a lot of that stuff. She used to sing with Luther, so she tells me
Luther
stories. She wrote them for a long time.
Oh, wow.
She's in Hamden tomorrow night, actually.
Where?
At the Small Batch Cellars, which is it's a winery in North Haven.
Oh, okay. Wow. Got last question, might be the most difficult of them all. Tell me your life story in one sentence.
In 1960-something, my sister walked into the room and said, holding a picture of Life magazine with a picture on the back of the Beatles getting their MBE awards from the Queen, And she said to me, "Do you know anything about this?" That just started a really a lifelong quest to know not just about them, but about everything. You know?
Right.
I mean, I worked with like the Rolling Stones producer for a lot of sessions back in the 70s. He, for a while, moved from, he lived in Fairfield.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he became friends with Doc Cavalier, who had Trod Nostril Studios, and we were the house band there. Mm-hmm. He would come up and hire us to do all these, including some Rolling Stones songs that I got to play on.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So, I mean, things, but yeah, it's just been that. You just follow a line throughout everything. And music is like that. You know, just everything leads to something else. No matter who it is that you're talking about, whatever artist, there's always something that went before it that you might want to find out about. And something that comes after it that you should find out about.
Right.
You know, that makes such a, it makes like a roadmap to a life.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. There's nothing like the backstory.
Well, absolutely true.
Yeah. You know? And that's my thing. I love the backstory because in it, when you know the backstory, it makes everything else make sense.
It makes sense. That's correct. You know, and if any business has backstories, it's music. You know,
oh, you're talking
about this. Yeah. When I was in college, the 2 years I was there, the guy running the music department was a guy, Ken McIntyre, and he played with Mingus.
Wow.
He was telling Mingus stories, you know.
Okay, okay.
Which was just fascinating, you know. Holy shit, Mingus, you know. It was great stuff. You know?
Wow.
And that stuff always goes on, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's not always good or bad. I mean, I've had people get in over their head in music and find themselves dead, you know, because they kind of borrow money from the wrong people.
Right, right, right.
And I've seen all that, and then I've dealt with it like down in Wilton. I mean, I actually was very good friends with all the mafia guys. They were great guys as long as you were on their side. Don't be on the other side, you know. But they were very pleasant, and they helped me. I mean, they got me out. You know, when there was trouble coming up, they pulled me aside and said, "Hey, you know, we like you. We don't want to see this happen." You know?
Right, right.
So, wow. I mean, all of those things just really add up in a different sort of way. Not too long, I mean, but recently, Charlie Karp, I don't know if you knew Charlie, he passed away, I think, 3 years ago now. And, Charlie was known for, he was a Staples High kid. Him and this guy, David Hull, they had a little band, and they used to play around. And they got hired one night. You know, Staples was the rock and roll high school. They used to have everybody used to come there and play. I don't know how they did that, but a movie about it, actually. A whole movie about the school. And so one day, yeah, you can look it up. Staples High.
Okay.
Buddy Miles shows up to play.
Yeah.
And his band, the Fun Band, you might or might not remember them, but they opened for Buddy. And at the end of the show, Buddy takes the two of his side and says, "You're leaving with me, and we're going on the road."
Wow.
And among other things, Charlie wrote some songs for Buddy. And he was around, and maybe 7-8 years ago, I kind of bumped into him down that way. And I was like, he had nothing going on. He had a little home studio, but it wasn't going anywhere. It's like, "You need a record. Let's make a record." And so we did, you know. Of course, when we finished the record, we were sitting here listening to the record. He says, "I don't feel well." And he goes to the hospital, he goes to the emergency room, they tell him he's got stage 4 cancer, and he's died dead 3 weeks later, gone.
Oh, man.
You know, I don't even know what to say about it, because he was so talented and so, so cool, you know. And Carol Sylvan, who I still produce today, was in his band. And we just sort of took the band and said, "Well, we're going to keep it going to honor this guy." And it's still going.
Oh, okay, okay. Wow, wow.
Lots of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. How can people contact you on social media?
Vic Steffens on Facebook. I don't really do Instagram.
I
just don't have time. But
oh, I hear.
Vic Steffens, S-T-E-F-F-E-N-S. You can find me there. You can call me at Horizon Recording Studios, 203-934-7186. You can email me at Steffmo, S-T-E-F-F-M-O. At AOL. I talk to everybody. I mean, I don't, you hit on me, even if I can't do anything, I'll at least tell you why or what it is.
Right.
But I like to meet new people. I like to make records with new people. I'd like to see more new people. You know? I mean, we see, right. We're busy, but you know, you never know when that's going to stop. So
exactly.
You kind of have to be careful to make sure that you're looking ahead into the future to do that.
Right. Yeah, no, and you guys are doing some great work over there as well, man. Yeah, appreciate
you. We're fine.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Playing,
you still have that band? Or you were playing with somebody?
Right? Yeah, I have a band called Altruistic.
Okay.
But
Altruistic, that wouldn't have something to do with Al.
Something like that, know. Yeah. But I retired from the college. I was at North Community College for 35 years.
Okay.
I retired at April Fool's Day, 2020. 2020. They sent us home March 10th because of this whole COVID thing. And so I'm thinking, all right, you know, we'll be out for a week, maybe two, and then we'll be back in. Well, like I said, March 10th, they sent us home. I didn't have the opportunity to go back and gather my belongings until September.
Oh, wow.
And when at that time, they said, you can come in for an hour. And so you had to get what you need to get and get out of there in that hour. You know, because the building was shut down and everything was done virtually and stuff. Mm. So it was interesting, man, because I, like I said, I've been there working there for 35 years and I got to get everything that I out of that office in an hour. It's like, you know, so I was like, I had plaques and certificates and, you know, I just threw that stuff. I shouldn't say that. Well, I threw it in the garbage, man. I couldn't take it with me. I had artifacts. I say artifacts, right? But I had paintings and statues and little things that I got from my travels, you know, in Africa and all over the Caribbean. And different people saw that I had these things, so they would bring me stuff. Like, I spent a year in Korea, so I had a couple of pieces from Korea. And then so someone brought me something from Vietnam, someone from Cambodia, different parts of Africa and Haiti. And so I just had this a wall of just all kinds of stuff and a bunch of books. And, you know, and I didn't have the opportunity to, I didn't have the time to go through everything. And my computer, I couldn't go through my computer. And, you know, it is what it is. So, you know, so I'm home and I'm thinking, okay, all right, so, you know, what am I going to do? Because I had planned prior to, I had some concerts, I had a couple of festivals, and then I had a bunch of recording sessions that I was going to do. And all of that stuff got canceled.
Wow.
And, you know, I was supposed to do something. Ron Lawrence was supposed to play on the project. You know, Marion has agreed to do some stuff. So, you know, at some point, I'll still try to make that happen. But, you know, for the first, you know, while everything was hot and heavy, man, all I did was sit on the couch in the living room.
Right.
I mean, in my family room. And I wore the couch out. You know, I practice every day at 11:30 at night. Now, I got all day to do stuff, but I don't start practicing until 11:30. But every night, you know, I put in that time.
That's cool.
But all I've been doing basically is playing golf and working on my podcast.
You know, I always remember the story you told me about Bill Cosby when you met him at Temple and gave him your record.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I see all the stuff that's happened with him. I'm like, yeah, okay, I get
it. Yeah, I know. And that's my frat brother too, man.
Oh, really?
So, I mean, you know, I go down there and I'm talking to him and I exchange pleasantries with him. And, you know, so that he knows I'm his fraternity brother and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so I gave it to him. He's like, yeah, no problem. You know, whatever. Okay, cool. And so we go back up because we had played. It was that arena in that the Temple plays at, the basketball and stuff. And so we go back up and where the band is all set up. And so we're watching him. He walks across and he walks over to the score table and he just drops it on the table and walks away. And I'm like, oh, come on, man. That's messed up, man. But it is what it is.
Wild. Yeah. Bizarre stuff. Do you see any of those cats any recently? Or do you see
I played on some stuff for him. I recorded some flute parts in my home studio, and So I see Joe, and plus he's my barber too. So and Tom.
Okay.
Yeah. Tom's a good golfer as well. So I've had the opportunity to play with him a couple of times. But from the band, from A Better Way, that's pretty much it. You know, mm-hmm. I haven't seen anybody else. Wes, the drummer, he passed away. Wes had sarcoidosis. I think that's how you say it. And so he was fighting it for a long time, and it eventually took him out. And Big Dave Pate, the trumpet player, he passed away as well. So
I have lists of people that have passed away. I mean,
During the pandemic, my bass player for Altruistic, Donnell Roberts, passed away. And Donnell was a really tasty bass player. And then the bass player that played for us before him was Keith Harper, which I know you know Keith. And Keith passed away. So, that was tough, man.
That was a one-of-a-kind period. I don't think you'll ever see it again.
No, not at all. Not like that. Not like that. Not like that. But... bro, I'm not gonna keep you, man. I appreciate you, man, for doing this for me, and I definitely
got to
get over there to see you soon. And
I
stuff.
Wish you would, yeah.
After the first of the year, I'm gonna be calling you because I got to get up in there myself. So definitely, man. After the first of the year, you know, looking to do some things. So.
Very cool.
Yeah. But once again, man, I thank you and I appreciate you, man. More than you know.
Thank you, and I feel the same way. I mean, I was always happy. One of the great guys that came through here, and I always, you know, felt that. I'm so happy to meet you.
Yeah, man. Thank you, man. Thank you.
All good.
Yes, sir.
See you, kids.
Okay. This has been another episode of In the Black of My Mind podcast. Make sure you like, comment, subscribe and share. Until next week, y'all be blessed.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou. forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com apply.